Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People started disappearing.
The Guzman just fell out of a helicopter.
Uh-oh, what's going on here?
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC.
Money is very, very dangerous.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday the 7th of June, these are our main stories. Donald Trump is back on the campaign trail for the first time since he was convicted of 34 counts of fraud.
So we're watching it very carefully, and I'm working my ass off to make sure we get too big to rig. Too big.
The United Nations says 35 children have been killed in one of the worst attacks in Sudan's civil war.
The war and the violations from the Rapid Support Militia makes my body shiver and are disgusting and unimaginable.
Also in this podcast.
In fact, they're being exposed to a cocktail of different drugs that can have all sorts of negative effects on wildlife and the ecosystems they inhabit.
How wild fish are becoming hooked on methamphetamine and other hardcore drugs. Donald Trump has made his first campaign appearance since his criminal conviction for fraud, addressing a friendly audience in Arizona.
Let me tell you, if we could have honest elections in this country, I would have stopped campaigning 2 weeks ago. We would have had it made. But we don't have that, so we're watching it very carefully, and I'm working my ass off to make sure we get too big to rig. Too big.
His supporters came out in force, hundreds queued in sweltering temperatures to get into the megachurch in Phoenix.
We're out here supporting Trump, and it is excruciatingly hot out here. We're using bottles of water to cool down our kids. It's hot.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable, but for us, the discomfort that Trump's been put under by the heat from the left, and so for us, coming out is the least we can do to support him at this point, because I mean the persecution is relentless, so for us coming out in the heat isn't a big deal to show our support, because for us it's not just supporting Trump, we're supporting the upholding of America. Really,
it's hot, and no matter how much water you use to pull yourself off, it dries up and you're just sweating and cooking out here in the heat.
Mr. Trump attacked President Biden's record on migration on the southern border. He also repeated his baseless assertions that the recent court case in New York was rigged and the charges against him were fabricated. Our reporter Emma Vardy was at the rally and spoke to me while Mr. Trump continued addressing the crowd.
Certainly among people here, when you talk to them, people say it's a sham. They see it as a politically motivated trial. People are, if you like, relishing the opportunity to demonstrate what they think of that conviction. People are wearing Trump's police mugshot on T-shirts. They are holding up his police mugshot on placards saying, never surrender. One Trump supporter I spoke to, she said to me, look, this is what we do. When they try to attack him, we turn it around and we use it as a PR opportunity. And that's what Trump has done throughout his trial.
Do these types of events tend to result in large amounts of donations for his campaign?
Well, a lot of leading Republicans have rallied behind Trump since his conviction. He's had a lot of big donations from here in Silicon Valley too, and he's been paying tribute to people today, and he's been boasting about those donations. In fact, the Trump campaign saying it's one of its busiest periods of donations ever since he was convicted. But of course, as you say, this is a very friendly audience here, but Arizona is in fact a very narrowly, closely run race in the presidential election. It was won by Trump in 2016. Narrowly won back by Joe Biden in 2020. And the campaign know that this is a must-win state for anybody who wants to win the presidency. And I was talking to a few undecided voters, not the sort of people you'd find at a Trump rally, but people away from here in Phoenix this morning. And there's an awful lot of apathy about this Joe Biden-Donald Trump rematch. Some people I was talking to said they'd voted their whole lives but didn't feel enthused to turn out once again and make a decision between these two candidates, taking each each on other, taking each one again. So, you know, we're seeing more evidence yet again that it could be the, in a very closely run state like this, the side that gets its vote out the most successfully that could make all the difference.
Emma Vardy. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's former adviser Steve Bannon has been ordered to report to prison to serve a four-month sentence for contempt of Congress. Last month, Mr. Bannon lost an appeal to overturn the federal court conviction. It found him guilty of refusing to give evidence in an investigation into the US Capitol attacks in January 2021. Mr. Bannon says he'll appeal to the Supreme Court. Nomia Iqbal is our North America correspondent.
He was a key strategist for Donald Trump. He didn't actually serve in the Trump administration in the final months, but he's still been this huge influence on the president and certainly on the political base. It was back in 2022 when he was convicted for defying that subpoena for the January 6th committee, sentenced to 4 months in jail. But the judge in the case agreed to let him appeal and to be on bail during that time. But it was back in May when a federal appeals court unanimously upheld that conviction. And so now the judge has come back and said, right, I'm ordering you to jail on July the 1st. So that lead up to the presidential election. It's worth me mentioning also that there is another Trump advisor who is already in jail serving a sentence over a similar charge. Peter Navarro, he was Donald Trump's trade advisor. He was also convicted of contempt of Congress. And when that happened, that was the first time in half a century that sort of charge had been brought forward and someone was convicted over it.
Nomia Iqbal. The US election in November is just one of many we've been covering. By the end of 2024, more than 50 countries and 2 billion voters will have gone to the polls. Here in the UK, a snap general election is taking place in just 4 weeks on the 4th of July. It's shaping up to be one for the history books, with both of the main parties needing to break records in order to form a government. If you have any questions ahead of the vote, from the main issues at stake to the main players, the Global News Podcast team would love to hear from you. You can email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. Now to Sudan, where we hear reports of further bloodshed and violence, this time in central Jazeera State. A United Nations agency says that 35 children were killed in Wednesday's attack by the rapid support forces in the village of Wad al Nura. The RSF has only said that it attacked a Sudanese army post in the area. Our deputy Africa editor Anne Soy reports.
It's yet another grim reminder of how children in Sudan have paid the price for the brutal violence, said UNICEF's executive director, Catherine Russell. She described the scenes in Wad al Nura village as devastating. The village neighborhood group said RSF fighters struck on Wednesday with heavy artillery, killing at least 100 people. Some estimates put the death toll at about 200. The UN resident coordinator in Sudan, Clementine Nkweta Salami, has called for an investigation into the attack. A pro-democracy lawyers group in the country called it a war crime.
The war between the RSF and the Sudanese government has killed many tens of thousands of people and displaced more than 9 million. We've been in touch with a man who fled his home in Jazeera State a week ago. In a voice message, he told us that decision saved his life.
My personal tragedy is very bitter. My cousins were killed in their homes. The women were raped and our money was looted. The rest of the family was assaulted and attacked. I was forcibly displaced. We've heard of all the wars that happened in other countries, but the war and the violations from the rapid support militia makes my body shiver and are disgusting and unimaginable.
A man displaced by the war in Sudan. Scientists say that many of the drugs we take routinely, antidepressants, contraceptives, even caffeine, are contaminating our waterways and having a significant effect on wildlife. And that's before you consider the impact of illegal drugs such as cocaine and methamphetamine. In a paper published this week in the journal Nature Sustainability, researchers say pharmaceutical companies need to improve how quickly their drugs break down in the environment. Michael Bertram was one of the researchers from the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences.
Recent study surveyed 104 countries and found a wide range of different drugs in river water all around the world. The most contaminated system had a mixture of 34 different pharmaceuticals. So the message here is not necessarily that a fish is being exposed to any single drug. In fact, they're being exposed to a cocktail of different drugs that can have all sorts of negative effects on wildlife and the ecosystems they inhabit. Prescription medications, but also illicit drugs, like anti-anxiety medications, for instance, have been found to reduce the anxiety and anti-predator behavior of fish. This is concerning given that prey fish should be scared of their predators and these fish aren't. Antibiotics, for example, have been widely detected in the environment with major implications for antimicrobial resistance. So the focus to date in terms of greening the pharmaceutical sector has been primarily on developing to reduce, for example, carbon emissions or to reduce the amount of plastics that are used in pharmaceutical products in terms of packaging. What we're concluding in this new article is that there needs to be a renewed focus on actually developing pharmaceuticals that actively degrade in the environment. The focus on that has been quite limited to date, and we need to make an effort to develop more greener drugs.
Dr. Michael Bertram from the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
The struggle between a dictatorship and freedom is unending. Here in Europe, we see one stark example.
U.S. President Joe Biden draws parallels between World War II and Russia's invasion of Ukraine as Western leaders mark 80 years since the D-Day landings. In our last edition of this podcast, we heard that the ruling military council in Myanmar has denied accusations that army troops killed at least 50 people in a village in Rakhine State in the west. They were looking for supporters of the Arakan Army, which has become one of the most effective ethnic fighting forces in Myanmar, causing the military junta to lose control of huge swathes of territory, including further north in Chin State. There, the BBC has been given rare access and seen evidence showing how the Burmese army has used torture, abduction and murder to stop young protesters joining the rebel fighters. Our correspondent Yogita Limaye sent this report.
Hundreds of young recruits are marching in a big open field under the scorching sun. We're surrounded by lush green mountains. We're at Victoria Base, which is the main headquarters of the Chin National Army. It's one of the rebel military groups that's been fighting against Myanmar's military. And over the past 6 months, this particular rebel group has made significant advances in this area. Our motherland, the land we love, they sing. We'll defend it with our blood and life. 3 years ago, Myanmar's fragile democracy was crushed by a coup. But now the military junta is facing an unprecedented challenge. People in many parts of the country are rising to fight against them. Like 19-year-old Tan Da Lim.
The first year after the coup wasn't too bad. But then the military began shelling our village. It destroyed our home. Troops entered our village, burnt houses, and killed people. My uncle was cruelly shot dead.
Driving through mountainous terrain, through heavily wooded forests, I've come to the village of Haimul. One of the things you see is on both sides of the road, there are quite a few burnt out homes. Somewhere, literally, there are a couple of pillars, wooden pillars standing and no other structure left. It's just everywhere you can see kind of charred walls. Pretty much nothing remains. Across Myanmar, allegations have been made by civil rights groups that tens of thousands of homes were torched by the junta. There was a steady battle between resistance groups and the military junta, and we're just about to speak to the commander. His name is Vala. Can you tell me what was your job before 2021 and why did you decide to join the People's Defense Forces then?
Before 2021, I'm driving truck. We don't want a dictatorship. We need a federal democracy government.
And how does your family feel about you being on a front line?
Sometimes they are so worried about me. but I must do this job for my son, my family, for our people, for our country.
Yogita Lemurier. For Tesla owner and space entrepreneur Elon Musk, Thursday was fourth time lucky, launching the biggest rocket ever built. This SpaceX test is aiming to send a rocket into space and have it return in a condition to be used again, and is key for NASA's goal of returning humans to the moon by 2026. Rachel Wright has more.
We are past the 42nd mark.
It's 7:50 US Central Time at Starbase in Boca Chica, Texas. Imagine the scene. A 121-meter rocket, the largest ever built, in the clutch of a huge metal clasp wreathed in smoke and fire. That noise represented twice the thrust of the rocket that sent men to the moon. It's the fourth test flight for Elon Musk's SpaceX Starship development program. The first didn't get into space, the last two did, but broke up during re-entry into the atmosphere. Engineers at Starship headquarters in Texas were very excited. And that's just the booster rocket landing safely into the Gulf of Mexico. The main Starship module was then coasting through space. The engineers waited with bated breath for the next bit. Would it, like the other two before it, disintegrate when it re-entered Earth's atmosphere?
This is a nail-biter. All this data is incredibly important. Even if, it breaks up right now.
Okay, we can see that. And then the cameras started to work.
The landing burn shutdown was commanded. And it sounded
Starship
like we might have got two engines.
The engineers, understandably delighted, because even though bits were falling off it, the spaceship did have a soft landing in the sea. If they can perfect Starship, it would be revolutionary. It's intended to be fully and rapidly reusable, to operate much like an aeroplane that can be refueled and put back in the air in short order. All previous spaceships have been partially or entirely expendable. A fully functional Starship would radically lower the cost of space activity. It's also the key to realising Elon Musk's long-held ambition to take people and supplies to Mars. And crucially, it's all at the service of NASA, which wants to use it to put astronauts back on the moon. SpaceX isn't the only company developing rockets to help NASA out. The aircraft producer Boeing is running a rival program, and today one of its Starliners successfully docked and delivered astronauts to the International Space Station.
Lots of cheering here in the room. Big hugs. Sunny William coming through in her blue flight suit. Oh.
And followed shortly behind by Commander of Starliner Butch Wilmore. Now back on the space station, the third visit for both astronauts and the first crewed flight test of the Starliner spacecraft.
A successful day for Boeing, but they're still 4 years behind Elon Musk's SpaceX.
Rachel Wright. Ukraine has ordered the evacuation of children and their guardians from those parts of the eastern Donetsk region it still controls. The regional governor said the situation there is constantly deteriorating as Russian forces shell the area with increasing intensity. Our Europe regional editor Sasha Schlichter told me why the order had come now.
It is rather surprising because there's been fighting all over the Donetsk region. But this is, I think, unfinished business, because in July 2022, just a few months after the full-scale Russian invasion, President Zelensky ordered mandatory evacuation of all children from Donetsk region. But it never followed it up, so I don't know how many were evacuated. Presumably, there wasn't many places they could go. So now, I would explain the timing, surprisingly, by the Russian offensive in Kharkiv, to the north of Donetsk region. Because if you remember, the past few months, the Russians have been advancing inexorably on the northeastern front and trying to, I would say, not capture Kharkiv, but maybe spook the Ukrainians to make them pull their forces from the east to the northeast. And I think that's what happened. They pulled them. And just two nights ago, President Zelensky, in his nightly video address, said that the main front line is no longer around Kharkiv, but back around Donetsk. When we say Donetsk, we mean Bakhmut, Avdiivka, Liman, which was briefly held by the Russians. Russians are trying to retake it again. So that's where all the fighting is. I don't think it's an accident that the other day President Zelensky said that this was the main front line. And today the governor, the Ukrainian governor of Donetsk region, said that all children plus their guardians have to evacuate, although not specifying where to.
So does this mean that the Ukrainian authorities are expecting another Russian push, or does it mean they're planning a push of their own?
I think the Ukrainians feel that the Russians are pushing westwards around Donetsk, trying to capture Liman, Chasiv Yar, and of course their main target would be Kramatorsk, which is now the only proper big city held by Ukraine in Donetsk region. So that's where the fighting will probably be.
Sasha Schlichter. Ukraine was at the front of many people's minds during ceremonies in France marking the 80th anniversary of D-Day, when Allied troops landed in France to start driving out the Nazis. Leaders from France, the US and Britain were present on the beaches of Normandy, but it wasn't President Putin of Russia who marked the sacrifices of the former Soviet Union. Instead, President Zelensky of Ukraine, another former member of the ex-Soviet Union, took the honours. He heard President Joe Biden urge Western powers to continue their support for Ukraine.
The struggle between a dictatorship and freedom is unending. Here in Europe, we see one stark example. Ukraine has been invaded by a tyrant bent on domination. Ukrainians are fighting with extraordinary courage, suffering great losses, but never backing down. The United States and NATO and a coalition of more than 50 countries standing strong with Ukraine. We will not walk away.
President Emmanuel Macron of France presented his country's highest military award, the Légion d'honneur, to veterans.
France will never forget the British troops who landed on D-Day and all their brothers in arms. That faith in freedom, which you have never lost, that constant selflessness and devotion both guide us and serve as a duty to us. We are honored by the ties of remembrance, friendship and loyalty which you have forged between our two countries. And let me thank all of you for this bravery.
Here are some of the sounds of a somber and memorable day. The first voice we hear is Britain's King Charles.
Let us pray such sacrifice need never be made again. And let us commit to carrying forward their resounding message of courage and resilience in the pursuit of freedom.
I said, I'll be back. I'll be back to see you, darling. I meant that.
I'm not a hero. The only heroes in any war are the ones that don't come back.
I really had the war in my ears, and it made me very much aware of what was at stake. But I know
we'll be together. Our gratitude is unfailing, and our admiration eternal.
Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away.
Our Europe editor, Katia Adler, has been looking at the legacy of D-Day.
Europe's new war hung heavy over today's D-Day commemorations. Modern-day geopolitics loomed large. But the world leaders gathered here meant no disrespect. The gratitude Joe Biden, France's Emmanuel Macron, the King and others today expressed to the Allied servicemen and women who risked and lost their lives in France was heartfelt. But concerns about Russia's bloody onslaught in Ukraine and fears of further destabilization in Europe were also palpable. In the US military cemetery this morning, President Biden urged allies to be unflinching against those he called tyrants. Remembering what happened yesterday doesn't absolve what we have to do today, he said. The valiant veterans who made it today to Normandy know only too well the dangers of unchecked authoritarianism, aggressive nationalism, and the politics of hate. The liberty and peace they sacrificed so much for is fracturing.
Katia Adler. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Peter Wise, and the producer was Ella Bicknell. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.